Let's talk.
John Brown.
DOA reimagined, remembering. It's the an album of a soundtrack that was. Now bear with me here, listeners, because the payoff is really good on this one. The album of a soundtrack has been unavailable. DOA was a movie starring Dennis Quaid. I saw it probably on VHS in the 80s because it was quite dark. But it's written. It's been reimagined by the great Chas Jankel, and I am delighted to say that the man, the maestro, the legend himself, looking rather sharp, I must say, joins me live on the line. Alas, not in the studio, but we go from my bear to Marlo. Good morning to you, Chas.
Good morning, Giles. How are you?
Well, I'm a bit of a precious today, but my voice sounds. I should be doing those denim adverts for commercials because my voice sounds more husky and butch than normal. you're looking rare form.
Sorry?
You look very well, sir.
Excuse me, I just clicked my throat.
Perfect timing. Perfect. Shall we start again? Ladies and gentlemen, I am joined in the studio. This is like a phlegm convention. We are joined in the studio by the one, the only, Chas Jankel. Chas, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, I know of who you are because, listen, you know, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. So, you know, a certain Kilburn and the High Roads a lot were around, and then it became the Blockheads, and everybody knows exactly where they were when you guys took to the stage at Top of the Pops and went, what on earth is that? But just talk me through your other stuff, you know, the development, because you obviously trained. I mean, you've written music that is popular in terms of chart success, but also this sort of more mellow sort of. Tell me a little bit about your musical journey, as they say.
Yeah, well, I mean, parallel to the work I did with Ian Dury, I'd always had a love of playing instrumental music. Mm. And I mean, my first instrument, I started playing piano and guitar around the age of 7. And you know, I was always oscillating between one instrument and the other. And, well, as you well know, the kind of stuff that I was doing with Ian doing the Blockheads was much more kind of, well, some would say it was kind of punky, funky kind of sound with notes of music hall. And so I thought that some of the music that I wrote outside of, you know, this instrumental music would not be appropriate to be played with the Blockheads, with Ian and the Blockheads. So I suppose in a way I looked for other outlets. And I was very lucky because my first score that I did was for a film called An Unsuitable Job for a Woman. And that featured actually a piece on my first album that I put out, my first solo album on A&M. It was a piece called Reverie. And they used that as a theme. Chris Pettit directed it. He was a journalist working for Melody Maker, who went into film direction, became a director. So that kickstarted everything in the 1980 in terms of film scores. And then, you know, fast forward to about 1986, in 1987, my sister Annabelle, who is a film director, she directed Max Headroom. She'd done a lot of music videos, including Accidents Will Happen for Elvis Costello. They did Genius of Love for Tom Tom Club. She even did something with Miles Davis. I don't remember the track, but they were really successful, prolific filmmakers, her and her partner at the time. Anyway, she got a 3-picture deal with Touchstone. And the first film they made was DOA, a remake of a film noir, and she asked me to do the score. So I went out to Los Angeles and I lived there for quite a few months, and had a little recording set up in her house up in the hills, and that's where I wrote the score. And I was really fortunate because I got to work with 19 freelance orchestral musicians, a string section, so to speak, and they interpreted a lot of the score that you'll hear on DOA. I did actually put some, at times, with some electric guitar on it, so, it, you know, there was that going on as well. Anyway, so we recorded the score, the movie came out, and the score, for a little while, was available on Varese Saraband, a soundtrack CD label. Well, they ceased trading early 90s. So for 25 years, excuse me, the soundtrack wasn't available. But my wife, Elaine, said she loved the soundtrack and she'd heard it before we met. So we went about trying to put things right. And we got hold of the original music and we remastered it, re-presented it, and made it into an album length. But also, I added one new piece, a piano sonata. Sorry, I've got a bit of a...
You have. So we're both doing well today, aren't we? You know, this show...
I know what it is. I think it's milk.
I think it's milk.
It could be the old milk in my tea. I think I might have to relax on that one. And yogurt. Anyway, back to just to finish off this little episode.
Yeah,
don't worry.
I'm happy here. Don't worry about you. You keep going, Charles.
Good one. Thanks, Giles. So anyway, I added one last piece of music to this original score, which was a piano sonata, and where I wove the different themes of the original score into one piece, and this is the album. And now it's up online. It's available through Kudos Records, or you could go to my website, chazjankel.com. And it's up online. It's available up online, yeah. It's called DOA Reimagined. That's the title of it.
Here's the thing, Chaz. When we were young, we wrote songs that we thought would get old poems that we thought were going to change the world, you know, at 17 or whatever, because we knew everything, you know, about love, life, and the universe. And then you go back, you know, sort of 40 years later, 50 years, and you look at it and you go, oh, for goodness sake. Okay. I mean, obviously, you never stop learning. In terms of music, that's the great thing about music. There's influences coming out that you never stop being amazed by music. That's why you know, Vonnegut said it was the proof of the existence of God. So when you go back to something, you find something like DOA. It's the joy of, you know, finding the stuff and reimagining it. But do you think of it now? And when you come to write that piano sonata, do you think, I wish I'd known that now or then when I wrote it, sort of thing?
It's a good question. I mean, not really. I just hope. Well, I hear what you're saying, because sometimes, you know, you look back or hear something that you did years and years ago and you think, I could have executed that better. But coming back to what you were just saying, I mean, we're learning the whole time. You know, you're adding. It's a bit like the earth. There's layer upon layer upon layer. And I think that's what learning is. You're just adding to that knowledge. And it's not, I think it's sometimes three steps forward and two back, because, you know, who knows the kind of, you might have been more direct when you were younger, you know, like that sometimes, although I'd like to think now I don't second guess myself so much, but you know, your energy, your physical energy is different when you're younger. So you might be more attracted to, say, club sounds. And as you get older, you might like the sound of the sea more, or just a light breeze. So, you know, your physical body, I think, also is affected. So you just change. You're just changing all the time, subtly changing. You know, I mean, these days, I don't particularly want to go to a concert and stand up all the way through. I'd be quite happy for an armchair.
But
at the same time, I do still love, you know, for example, I love Afro-Venezuelan music. I love a good rhythm, don't get me wrong. I've been very lucky, Giles. I mean, I'm a bit of a butterfly when it comes to music. You know, I like a bit of this, a bit of that, as you've witnessed here. And I've survived. Mm. A bit like a big shotgun blast of music. I somehow, you know, every now and again, a pellet hits a target.
But I mean, when you say you're a bit of a butterfly, I want to ask you about the writing as well. But you know how people say, oh, well, the problem, you know, the thing is, you know, the UK is too multicultural and it's all this, that, the end, it's gone woke. But as a musician in the 70s, that was what the UK was like. I mean, the bands that, you know, I like was, you know, and I'm not blowing smoke up or office I can find, Chaz, because it's too early. But, you know, it was, you know, the Special Selector. You know, we had these great, you know, bands who'd been influenced by all sorts of music. And of course, the Blockheads, multicultural, absolutely. You know, I grew up with Sly and the Family Stone going back a generation before, you know, bringing white people playing soul stroke funk, you know, all that sort of stuff. And the great thing was they weren't, I mean, people said, oh, it was pub rock. Well, that was just the way they started. But you guys brought in so many influences. I mean, look at the stuff that Madness is doing, why, because, you know, which is why the guys doing Scar, which was kind of unheard of up until the Prince. So it was a fascinating time. And the thing with the Blockheads, and I'll let you get a word in edgeways, was the fact you brought all these great musicians and all these influences with a front man who'd come straight out of the Victorian market, but who was an incredibly intelligent and nuanced person. It's 25 years, hard to believe. And that was one of the great things about music, because it took in all those and put it in a chart friendly format. Good trick if you can pull it off, and you guys did.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to follow that.
Just say yes. It's all right. Say thank you. Yes. Checks in the post.
Next.
No, but I'm saying you got all those influences. I mean, taking all those influences to, you know, in must have been, and working with those musicians, all bringing something different, like the Avengers, you know?
You know, you're absolutely right. And what a wonderful gift to be able to, you know, grow up in that time when there was this freedom. There was a lot of anger as well, you know, like to do with the Thatcher government and you know, a lot of mines were closing, weren't there? There was a lot of strikes and all kinds of things going on. I suppose there always will be. There's always going to be dissent. And out of that, though, there was this kind of, well, there was a movement probably a lot of times starting in art schools, actually, in art schools. And a lot of that flamboyance and a lot of the kind of style was, you know, was coming from art schools. And I know Jarvis Cocker went to art school, so to speak. I went. Ian went. Ian was taught by Peter Blake, you know. So there was this kind of very beautiful, you know, like a visual sense, a colourful sense. Also, as you've just pointed out, you know, anything was fair game at that point. Musically, people were drawing from all these different sources. I think a lot of the acts that were popular, like Free, the Small Faces, The Who, you know, they were, in a way, I have to say, were borrowing a lot from the States. But because they were from Surrey and places like that, you know, they couldn't sound like John Lee Hooker or you know, or James Brown. They had an Englishness that fronted these sounds, which I would say were primarily American, but, you know, but in a way done it in an English way, you know, with English overtones, so to speak. And I think this has always been the case. We've been bouncing backwards and forwards between the States. When ska came along, obviously, there was the Jamaican influence. I think from my point of view, let's finish that sentence off. Jamaican point of view via Bristol or via, you know, like with people growing up in England, but with West Indian roots. From my point of view, my musical direction really changed when I was in my teens, because I was on a holiday, funny enough, in Torremolinos, and a cousin of...
Okay, here we go. This is all right. Like 30 minutes down the road from where I'm sitting now, so here we go. Come on.
Here we go. Actually, I've just come back from Mallorca, so I wasn't that far from you, you know.
It's a long pedalo ride, but I would have done it, Chaz. All right, off we go. Come on. So tell me about your Torremolinos experience, if it's fit for air, darling. Come on.
Well, okay. So, yeah. So what happened was, a cousin of mine had a little portable record player, and she put on Lee Dorsey, Working Down a Coal Mine. There's a single, Working Down a Coal Mine, et cetera, et cetera. Great track. But if you flipped it, there was a great B-side called Get Out My Life, Woman. And Get Out My Life, Woman. I can tell you're a soul freak because some of the music you've just been talking about, that had the great drum intro. And I thought, what's that? What's that? I thought, oh, that's a backbeat. I found out snare. And I thought, wow, this is so funky. And in a way, I'd been missing that. Not to say my life was empty of musical influence, because I'd loved the Beatles. I was the biggest Beatles fan. However, they were a melodic-based group. The, you know, the groove was, I always thought, was secondary to the songs. Mm. But here, American, Afro-American music, the beat, the groove, the rhythm was absolutely where it all built from. And from that moment onwards, I turned my ears towards the States, and but particularly soul music. And so when I got to about my late teens, one day I went down to, I was following Sly and the Family Stone. I got into them.
Yeah.
Might probably be my greatest influence in my life musically, one of them. So anyway, I go down and I went down to this little record shop just off Charing Cross Road. And it was one of those shops where you could preview a single before you bought it. You actually had to put on a headphone, pair of headphones in a little booth.
Little booth, yeah.
And Sly had just released Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again, right? Okay, so I put the headphones on and I listen to this thing and it goes boom, boom, boom. Okay, so I'm thinking, oh, this is good, but it doesn't change key, it doesn't do anything, it just sits there, doesn't it? Nothing really happens. Anyway, I thought, well, I better buy it in case, I don't know, I'll just buy it anyway. So I went back on the tube trainer, you know, the tube, and I got home, went to my bedroom, opened my record player, put it on, gave it a listen, and I went, no, I don't get this, I better listen to it again. No, it doesn't have nothing. And I played it a third time, and I went, hang on a moment. I thought, oh, my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. And I was boogieing around my bedroom for about a good hour. You know, I practically worn out the grooves. And I suddenly, the penny dropped, and I think, this is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And to be honest, I took that influence to Ian. Ian didn't realize it immediately when I in Dury when I you know first joined them they didn't really know I was a songwriter. All they knew was I had a Wurlitzer electric piano, but as time went by and I was playing this, as you mentioned it, I suppose a lot of people today would call it pub rock. Well, it was a bit of this, bit of that, bit of kind of, it was quite angst driven eccentric, but yeah, there wasn't a lot of soul in it. So you know, so one day I said to him, hey, man, do you fancy writing some songs? And he went, oh, I'd love that. And so one of the first songs we wrote was Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And that was an important song. Didn't get played on the BBC. But
Strangely enough, but there you go.
It did get, yeah. And we're still playing it to this day. We go out, you know, that's one of our, in our repertoire, the Blockheads repertoire. And it went from one thing to another. So I never, you know, would turn my back on any of Ian's music hall influence. For example, Billy Ricky Dicky, once again, is a huge song in our set. And audiences seem very happy to listen to that and then to hear something like Clever Trevor or even Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. They all sort of seem to dovetail into each other. So it's, even though style-wise they're quite different, audiences never seem to have an issue with that. And but when we started, Giles, very few bands were just hopping over genre fences, so to speak. They would stick to a channel. You had blues bands, you had reggae bands, you had ska bands. But you come back to your original question, you know, Ian, I never once heard him say the word genre, ever. You know, if he presented me with a lyric, it was just then down to me to paint the appropriate musical background for it or environment, and that's all I've ever done really with anything I've written. And you know, sometimes, well, as time went by and we wrote more and more songs, I would offer up musical ideas to him, which he would write lyrics to, and that would bounce backwards and forwards. But you asked me also about my other, you know, the music I've written. And so got to about 1980 and we'd released Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. It had become a, you know, number one in England. And on the back of that, whilst we're on tour, actually, we were in Amsterdam. I came up with a melody for I Know Corrida. And so that once again didn't feel right for the Blockheads.
Strangely enough, eh? Because I mean, that's a Quincy Jones. I mean, it was like he did what? Because you know, in the middle of Hit Me With Your Rheumatic Madness, etc. You come up with I Know Corrida, or you know, we don't have the bullfight today in Spain. Yeah,
exactly. Well, that's funny you should say that because you know. A very short little story. I'll try and keep it short. The guy who wrote the lyric for it was a guy called Kenny Young. And he'd been to Midem, the music festival in the south of France. And he calls me one day. I just give him a melody. And he'd come up with this lyric. And he calls me, "Hey, Chaz, I got this melody, you know, a lyric for your melody." He says, it goes like this. "I know Corrida." And I went, "What's he talking about? I had no idea." And then he starts to explain to me it was the title of a Japanese erotic film of the same name. And he said it's actually Japanese, but they called it In the Realm of the Senses. And also, I found out very recently, it also means love of the bullfight. Well, so all I wanted was a kind of lighthearted love, maybe not love, but just I never knew we were going to go as deep as that on the lyric.
Anyway, Realm of the Senses, yeah, exactly. Japanese art house, quote deep. Unquote. Yeah.
It is, you know. I mean, I thought this is, anyway, I ran with it because I didn't have another lyric. I ran with it. One thing led to another. It was the opening track on my first album on A&M. They signed me on that song and one other song, Am I Honest With Myself, Really. Both songs went on my first Chaz, the album was called Chaz Jankel on A&M. And so that actually was kickstarted my own recording career. Some would say a solo career. I hate that word solo. But anyway, it was outside of Ian and the Blockheads. And that was traveling along. As I mentioned, the last song on the album, Reverie, was used in a movie that I mentioned, An Unsuitable Job for a Woman.
Yeah.
So there it was. There were these different poles, you know, like yin and yang, really.
That's important, isn't it, if you're writing? Because if you write just for one sort of style, i.e. we're going to write a Blockhead song, and we only do that, you've got to have, you know, another outlet for your ideas. I mean, you've got one of the greatest names. Chazablanca is a great name for an album, by the way. But you're the same, because you have people who write, okay, I'm going to write stuff which is for Blockheads, and I'm going to write stuff for my own pleasure, because... Again, no genres. You just write. I mean, the thought of you coming up with "Touch Me" and you know, I Know Corrida, it's got like the cheesy lyrics of all time. But you know, again, it gets the Quincy treatment. It's a massive hit.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you learn from it. I mean, when my original version was 8.5 minutes long.
Oh, right, and fine.
And I remember the day the courier came in on a bike, and he handed us Quincy Jones's single. And this was months after we'd recorded ours, and we quickly put it on the record, you know, and put it on the record player, and there it was, 3 minutes 45 of genius with Herbie Hancock on keys, and Louis Johnson from the Johnson Brothers on bass. I mean, heavy stuff, you know. So I was, God, blimey, and you know, and there was always this air around his productions. It was like, how does he do that? Well. So that was that, really. And my second album, which was actually called Chazanova, we hadn't got to Chazablanca at that point. You know?
Chazanova.
By the way, yeah. Sorry, mate. I mean, I have to say, I didn't come up with these titles, but not, I mean, once again, you know, I'm stuck with it. However, on Chazanova, which was called Questionnaire in America, because that was the title of one of the tracks, there was a track that became really successful in America called Glad to Know You, which was a huge club hit in America, number one for 6 weeks on the Hot 100, the Billboard chart. And once again, I'd written that with Ian, but, it, you know, in England at that point, early 1980s, club culture hadn't really hit. What I'm saying is, you know, yeah, you had your ska, you had all those kind of things going on, but heavyweight club music hadn't really, it was not center stage at that point, actually. It became that in the 90s, in the late 80s and 90s.
It sort of came out of Chicago with a whole Philly sound, and then we had the urban groove thing, and everybody was buying rare imports with black things, and not, you know, all that came. But that was like 87, 88, not 1980, 1980, 81.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I had that thing going on that was happening for me in the States, but not in England. So I, you know, and got to about 1986, and I actually moved to Los Angeles, and I lived there to about 92. I did come back to England, and I did a couple of film scores, Killing Dad, War Party. I did another score in America called K2, for a movie called K2. And so then eventually I came back and I decided to come back to Europe. I decided to come back, and then I started making music again with Ian. We made an album called Mr. Love Pants, a great album. And but then very sadly, Ian got cancer. And so from 96 to 2000, he was having treatment. Mm. And we ended up making our last album together called 10 More Turnips from the Tip. but we only managed to write six songs together. Robbie Williams helped us out on one of the songs. I sang one of the songs, and that was it. Mm. It gets to 2000, and the cork went in the bottle, and that was all that was all I'd ever write with Ian. And but then since that, well, Phil Jupiter stood in for a few gigs because he loved Ian's lyrics and his poetry. And then Derek the Draw, who was Ian's minder, unpaid, I must say, he then sang for quite a few years, just before lockdown. And then he passed away. And then we were very lucky to get a chap called Mike Bennett, who's a... very prolific in his own way, and so now we've done with the Blockheads. He's been singing with the Blockheads. We've done about 80 gigs together, and you know, just a few weeks ago we were in Scotland, and we still travel all over the UK. But Giles, as you can imagine, with the kind of vocals we have, they're very English.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really travel globally.
You should have an interpreter. Right, I've got 2 minutes before I crash the news, Chaz, right? So
okay,
let's go for it, because otherwise I'm going to upset ITN and they're going to get very upset with me when we go down the line. So, I mean, look at it now. I mean, you're still, you know, the crowds, you're still getting the crowds in. You're still doing lots of different projects. Ian is still revered for combining that music hall, but eccentric and self-depreciating lyricist. But the music is still bloody good. So what are you hoping that people are going to rediscover, you know, from a DOA Imagined? And where can they check out your music?
So DOA, they can find it online. Either through Kudos Records, KUDOS, you can find it there, or through my website, chazjankel.com. It's a lot of it. I have a YouTube channel. A lot of it's on Spotify and, you know, Apple Music. It's all up there. I like to try and make it as available as possible. What else can I say? Yeah, I mean, thank you very much, Giles. I've loved talking to you.
The pleasure's been all mine. I'm now going to push for a blue plaque to be put somewhere in Torremolinos for when you flipped over working on it in a coal mine with the tricky guitar solo, three notes I think, or maybe four. But it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And Chaz, honestly, when I was in my teenage years, you guys provided the soundtrack. So thank you for that as well, for opening those doors as well. Chaz Jankel, thank you so much for your time today.
That's a pleasure, Giles. Brilliant.